I should be a dead man. I was once, a long time ago, a low-life punk teenager who cared nothing for the home I grew up in, nothing for the family that loved me, nothing for the place I lived in, a crummy town in the midst of a crummy state, and nothing for the life I lived before the trenches. They never taught it in school, how to dig a pit that serves as your future grave, or how to ward off the piercing chill of sleeping outside in the mud and the rain. Not even how to shake off the creeping dread that prevents the very sleep, living in fear that the enemy could sneak in during the night, or worse, pneumonia. I never cared for Europe. I slept through all the history classes and failed most of its tests. I was told that the British were our enemies, but now I fight alongside them across the sea, drafted into a war I knew little about and cared for a lot less. As long as I was allowed to drink a few years early, I wouldn't remember the time I wasted here anyways. Not like I hadn't drank liquor before, but it just feels different when you could just buy it and not have to sneak it away from a clerk or from my father's cabinet. There were a lot of things I despised about war beside the obvious. Having to fight overseas with a ragtag collection of Europeans tends to involve a lot of charades. Language barriers went both ways. It took me some time to get over being angry at the other guys when they had no clue what I was saying. I still know simple stuff I learned from back then. Phrases in French, Spanish, even Swedish. Things like hello and goodbye and mustard gas. I hated the long, quiet days that passed with no sound other than the whistle of the wind, followed by endless hours of ear-rupturing explosions and gunfire, only to return to the quiet again, like an unspoken agreement between us and the enemy. I can't imagine what top brass thought of us using up thousands of dollars of ammunition just for it to sink into the mud instead of some poor German kid's chest. But one thing stood out among the trenches, the automatons. The mechanical man, or so they called them back then. I couldn't tell you the first thing about how they're built or how they made them as smart as the average guy, but they did. Turning cogs and gears plated in copper, two little light bulbs for eyes glowing a soft yet ugly shade of yellow. I hated how the people that made them wanted them to fit in with the other soldiers. Making the gears turn in a certain way tricks the eye, making it seem like their chest is rising and falling, like they need to breathe, or that they had a man's voice, capable of keeping conversation with us and calming us down. For some reason, they were given names based on the states back home, top brass's way of adding to the familiarity or comfortability or something else just as stupid. They were field medics, artillery crewmen, and damn good ones too. Plus, the non-living part meant that they could take 20 times as many bullets as us and still keep kicking, and didn't have to wear a filthy gas mask. They rusted like hell. They would have to be cleaned and oiled every other day because of the mud. We just had the recruits and the wounded do it. They kept their minds busy. They moved a little slow and couldn't see further than a few feet without turning up the brightness on those lights, which was a death wish at night. There was one assigned to our platoon by the name of Connecticut, which at the time I thought was just a stupid name and a poor choice. Although he followed our commands, despite the bullying and teasing we put it through, it kept us away from Borden. It took charge of every medical emergency and could easily calm anyone from panic whenever they were shot, stabbed, or just missing their left leg. It came with all the stops and medical tools, painkillers, antibiotics, even a stack of crutches. I took a liking to him after a while. The thing was too damn good at a game of cards to believe it wasn't cheating somehow, and he knew more jokes than I'd seen in any book full of them. He saved the captain from a gunshot that should have killed him, but instead he's just got a scar that he shows off to the ladies at the bar as he hops around nowadays. But there is one thing about Connecticut I'll never forget. We pushed forward far enough that the enemy barely had a foothold left. The field we'd spent months in looked like a cereal box maze from above, but this one had no exit. Our stretch of trench was shelled, and I awoke half buried in a mudslide, unable to lift my body from the thick mud. I sat there for several minutes, silent with shock. Then I began shouting for help. I waited there for over an hour. I began to slip into unconsciousness as the lack of air was getting to me. Soon after, I heard footsteps, so I cried out to get their attention. The answering voice was an unwelcome one. As I heard a few harsh barks of orders in German, I started to panic. A soldier then stepped in the rubble ahead of me and shouted to his fellows topside. I tried to plead with him as tears rolled down my face, but after he heard his officer's reply, he leveled his rifle to my head. Suddenly, we both heard a loud crack above us, and the German shouted a questioning tone. After he didn't get a reply, he spun on his heels, but it was too late. Connecticut had dropped down into the rubble with us, and they both traded a shot into each other. After the soldier fell, Connecticut walked over to me, calmly asked me if I had any severe injuries, and I noticed he had lost his left arm and was littered with bullet holes. He surveyed the rubble, and after propping a support beam above me, he effortlessly pulled me out. My leg was shattered, and I could barely hobble. He then told me, "You hold the gun, and I'll hold you." As we climbed out of the foxhole, we started for our staging zone. We slowly crossed the blasted trenches for several miles until we reached the rest of our platoon survivors, but as we entered the camp, Connecticut collapsed. His fuel tank was smashed, and he had been running on fumes the whole time. Most of his parts were in disrepair, and we were unable to put him back together. We buried him next to the others who died that night. When I returned to America, I moved to Connecticut with my childhood sweetheart and our two kids. I didn't have any family there or anything. It just seemed like a comfortable place to go. Now every morning when I wake up, I thank the top brass for sending a piece of home with us.